Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and welcome to the student question forum part of this event. My name is Tom Coulton, and I'm a Year 13 student at King's College.
And my name is Zoe Tietzer, and I'm a Year 13 student at Diocesan School for Girls in Auckland. On behalf of all the students at Church Schools, we warmly want to welcome all of our guests to Auckland and hope you have enjoyed the pōwhiri today, our traditional Māori welcome.
Throughout the past few months, students at Anglican schools in the Auckland and Waikato region have put together a variety of questions that they would like to ask the leaders of the Anglican Church. We have a group of students here today from both primary and secondary schools to pose these questions for our panel to answer.
It is our great pleasure to introduce our group of panellists who have travelled from around the world to be at the Anglican Consultative Council meeting.
First of all, we are pleased to welcome Archbishop Rowan Williams. Archbishop Rowan comes from Wales and has been a bishop since 1992. He is the current Archbishop of Canterbury and has held this role since 2003. As the 104th Archbishop of Canterbury, he is the symbolic head of the Anglican Communion worldwide and the leader of the Anglican Church. Welcome to Auckland, Your Grace.
Next on our panel, we have Bishop Catherine Jeffett-Scorey, presiding bishop and primate of the Episcopal Church in the United States of America. Bishop Catherine has been a bishop since 2001, and in 2006 was the first woman in the Anglican Church to become the presiding bishop of a province.
We are also very privileged to have Archbishop Thabo Magoba, Archbishop of Cape Town and Primate of the Anglican Church in Southern Africa. He has been a bishop since 2002 and is the youngest person to have been elected as Archbishop of Cape Town. It is wonderful to have you here in New Zealand, Archbishop Thabo. And we hope you enjoy your time here.
So to get this forum started, we have some of our younger students who are going to ask you their questions. Some will be addressed to the entire panel, and some will be to specific individuals, and the students will indicate who the questions are addressed to before they ask them. First up, we have Jack.
Hello, my name is Jack Doherty Eagles, and I go to King's School. This question is for the Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams. At my school, we hear stories from the Bible in chapel and in our classes. What is your favourite Bible story and why do you like it?
I think my favourite Bible story has to be Jesus' story of the prodigal son. The son who runs away from home because he's bored and asks his father for money, goes and wastes all the money, and then, very embarrassed, feels he has to go back and say sorry. But before he's got a chance to say sorry, his father is out there to meet him and embrace him and welcome him home. And that's wonderful in itself, but there's also the end of the story where the older brother sees all this and says, "So I've been wasting my time being good all this time?" And the father says, "Look, you haven't got a problem. You live here. I love you. I hope you love me. Don't think about it. But this, your brother, he went away. He was lost. And now he's been found. So, you know, plenty to celebrate." I think that's a fantastic story. And I think it still is the story at the very, very heart of what it is to be a Christian.
That is a lovely story. Next up. Next up, we have Emma.
Hello, my name is Emma Wong Shi, and I go to Diocesan School for Girls. This is a question for each of you. Why did you want to be a bishop?
Thank you very much. I didn't want to. But that's a beautiful question. I think a bishop is a servant of the servants. So we are all motivated by serving God in others and serving God through nature and encouraging everyone to see the beauty of each other, the beauty of God's creation. That was a very special question. Thank you.
Emma, thank you for a wonderful question. Like Archbishop Tabo, I did not go looking for this work. But a bishop is a person who builds bridges, between different sorts of people, people who live in different communities and parts of the world, and bridges between human beings and the rest of creation. God made us all to be connected with each other and to care about each other. And a bishop's job is to remind people about that and to encourage them to go across those bridges into new and sometimes scary places. It's a great privilege to do that kind of work, but it's work that every human being can share.
Well, it's obvious that none of us really wanted to be bishops. But I guess if the question is, why did you say yes when you were asked to be? The answer would be very much what Catherine has said. The opportunity of trying to build community, trying to shape the way people think and pray and work with them to bring the fullest out of them, and to try to keep people in touch with each other, which is occasionally hard work, but very, very, very important. And I think that's the essence of what the bishop's job is. And it is a privilege, and hard work as it may be, it really needs to be done. And I echo very strongly what Catherine has said, that it's everybody's job. And we don't have bishops so that nobody else has to do it. You know, that's a really, really important thing. Bishops just kind of remind everybody else to do it by having to do it all the time.
I must say, in particular, I really liked what you said, Bishop Catherine, about building bridges. I think that's really important. Next up, we have Charles to ask his question.
Hello, my name is Charles Mills, and I go to King's School. This question is for Archbishop Rowan. Is it fun being the leader of a church?
Oh dear, is that the time? Well, it depends which day of the week you ask me. When people ask me that sort of question, I always say the one thing it never is boring. And there's a difference, actually, between something being fun, which comes and goes, and something being joyful, because you can get a lot of joy in a calling like this, even when it's not exactly fun. So when I thank God for calling me to this job, which I do sometimes through gritted teeth, I say, thank you for the joy, the unexpected joy, even when it's not exactly fun.
Thank you, Archbishop Rowan. Can Sadie please ask her question?
Hello, my name is Sadie Simich, and I go to Diocesan School for Girls. This question is for everyone on the panel. If God wore shoes, what sort of shoes do you think God would wear?
If God wore shoes, my first response is I think God would wear dancing shoes. I'm not sure that God needs shoes. And if the divine toes are free, I'm sure that they will enjoy the earth that the Holy One has created. But I think God rejoices in what is, in what God has created, and that's why I think dancing shoes are most essential.
I think if God wears shoes, God will wear hunter boots. like Catherine, I think God will fit in each one of us shoes, and we will also fit in God's shoes. And God's shoes will be those that enable us to go where we would rather not go in order to take his love, his compassion, and his peace. Thank you.
I must say, these are amazing questions. I think God would wear shoes he could take off easily, so that he could put his feet firmly on the earth, which is what he does, and so that he could give his shoes away when he met people without any, and so that he could let us wash his feet when we meet him in the poor, just as he washes our feet in his love.
I must say, I would have had to thought a lot more before being able to answer that question. I just want to say thank you to Jack, Emma, Charles, and Sadie for your questions. There are some big issues facing the Anglican Church at the moment, so next up we have some questions about those issues. Could Maria please ask a question?
Hi, my name is Maria Cardi, and I go to Diocesan School for Girls. We know that there are some parts of the Anglican Church that do not have women priests. Bishop Tabo, how do you feel about women becoming priests or bishops in the Anglican Church, and why do you hold that opinion?
I think the Anglican Church should have women priests, and I hold that opinion because we are all created in God's image, and God has no favorites. In God there are neither Jews nor Gentiles, and God has called all of us to serve. I'm happy to say in the Anglican Church of Southern Africa, we have just celebrated 20 years of the ordination of women to the priesthood, and I want to say, yippee, we've got two new bishop-elect who are women and are going to be consecrated.
Thank you, Archbishop Tabo. We now have a question addressed to the Archbishop Ron. Lucy.
Hi, my name is Lucy Stevens, and I go to King's College. Archbishop Rowan, this question is to you. How have attitudes towards women in ministry in the Anglican Church changed over the past 40 years?
I think they've changed very rapidly. I grew up in a church where it was just not thought about very much that women might be in roles of leadership. And although we made the right noises about the dignity and equality of women, it didn't really occur to people that that somehow affected how we did things in the church. And even when I was a student, the idea of the ordination of women was quite a long way off. So things have moved a great deal. But one thing I'd want to say, partly because it's a big thing on our agenda in these coming weeks, is this. We rightly celebrate, and I quite agree with Tabo, rightly celebrate the way in which women's ordained ministry has become part of the life of so many bits of the Anglican Church. But the whole issue of the dignity and the security of women more generally is something that is so important in so many countries that we mustn't, if you like, just treat this as a churchy affair. This is about the whole of our society, and whether we live in a society that degrades women, a society that doesn't allow women to be safe, a society which turns its face away from violence against women, that sort of thing. That's going to be very much on our agenda in the weeks ahead, and I think that's a crucial witness that our church and every church ought to be carrying forward. Thank you.
being at an all-girls school, it'll be interesting to hear how that carries on, so we're very interested in that. Now, I would like to thank Maria and Lucy for asking your question. We've also got Corey to ask the next one.
Hi, my name is Corey Anderson, and I go to DeWitt School. This question is for Archbishop Rowan. Here in New Zealand, we currently have a bill before Parliament about same-sex marriage. What does the Anglican Church have to say about this issue?
Oh, thanks a bundle. The short answer is that the Anglican Church has quite a lot to say about this issue, but it's not always the same thing that people are saying. I'd say that for the vast majority of Anglicans in the world, the idea of same-sex marriage is not one they can come to terms with. Even those who want to say that some kind of recognized public partnership for people of the same sex is a good thing, even they are not too sure whether calling it marriage is right, if marriage is something with all the kind of symbolic and theological focus that it's had in the Bible and in Christian history. So it's not something which I think the Anglican family worldwide is going to embrace in a hurry. That being said, it certainly focuses for us another set of very delicate, very difficult issues, which mean that we have to face the fact that as Christians we have so often been rejecting and even violent towards people with same-sex attraction. And we have a lot of repenting to do there. We have a lot of ground to make up. And if we are going to say, well, we're not happy about same-sex marriage, we must be very careful not to say it in a way that just underlines prejudice and violence towards people who experience same-sex attraction.
Just before we go on to the next question, I would just like to ask Archbishop Tarbo and Bishop Catherine if you have anything to comment on this issue.
Fools rush in. Many people have found it difficult to hear what the Episcopal Church has said about these issues through its general convention. Our understanding as a whole church is that people with same-sex attraction seek the same ability in life to live in a covenanted relationship with another person whom they love. That is can be a holy thing, that human beings were not created to live alone, which is what Genesis says, and that therefore the church's task is to help all human beings live in holy relationships that can show the love of God to a world much in need of it. Where we differ is about what that looks like. And I think that's where the conversation is having its most creative possibility. I doubt that we will ever all agree about what that covenanted or holy relationship looks like and where the boundaries of it are. But if we are unable to have the conversation, we are going to do violence to human beings who need not to live alone. Not all of us are called to live in monasteries or convents. Some people are, but not all are. It's a conversation that the Episcopal Church has been having for nearly 50 years, and we do not yet all agree. We never will, but we must have the conversation.
I think, like my colleagues, we are on a journey on this particular pastoral matter. It is painful for those that believe that the church ought to make certain dogmatic principles concerning same-sex marriage. It is equally painful for those who believe that there are Christians and find themselves called to be in that state. But what is important is to respect the dignity of each person as created in God. As one of my predecessors once said, the Holy Spirit is not yet finished with us on this matter. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your opinions. I would just like to call Annalise to ask her question now.
Hi, my name is Annalise Hassel and I go to Diocesan School for Girls. Archbishop Rowan, if you could change any decision that you've made during your time as the Archbishop of Canterbury, what would you change and why?
You mean like the decision to come and take questions this morning? It's a very tough question, and I honestly don't know where to start, because I can think of any number of decisions I've made which I wish I hadn't made or hadn't had to make. And sometimes there's a difference between feeling you have to make a decision, it's the best thing in the circumstances, but it's not a particularly good one, and I've had loads of those, and then you have to live with the pain that that causes to other people. And sometimes you just get things simply wrong. And I just think it would take too long to go over all that. But I am very conscious, because it's one of the things that comes, I suppose, with being a bishop or an archbishop or anybody in a public role, conscious of those times when, actually, especially in relation to some of the other issues we've been talking about, around sexuality and so forth, it is unavoidable to take some decisions in the name of the whole church, and you know that they're going to hurt people very badly, and you just have to be aware of the need to stay with the people that it hurts and do the best you can. There have been a lot of those, and I think it's just something about not expecting yourself always to be liked, always to get things right, always to be at the leading edge of change. It's part of the position, part of the job. And I think for any of us growing up at all, in any context, it's a matter of recognizing that often there just aren't decisions you can make without causing somebody some pain, and living with that and living with the consequences of it.
I must say I've had my fair share of bad decisions as well. Thank you for that, Archbishop Ron. Thank you also to Corey, Annalise and Bowen for your questions. We have another general question about the young people and the church. So could Charlotte please ask your question now?
My name is Charlotte Wilford and I go to King's College. The question is for the whole panel today. The church in many parts of the Western world seems to be in decline. Why should young people join the Anglican Church? What does the church have to offer young people today?
The Anglican tradition has a great deal to offer young people and older people. In this day and age, we are a tradition that takes very seriously the need to use this, to use the stuff between your ears, not simply to accept answers that have been handed down from parents or authority figures, but to wrestle with what a moral decision looks like given your context, what you read in Holy Scripture, what the best of your ethical conversation with your neighbors tells you, and then to make a decision that may cause the kind of pain that Archbishop Rowan was talking about. We believe we have a tradition that encourages that kind of wrestling and helps young people and older ones to find the courage to step out and deal with the consequences of challenging decisions. We think that's a very important thing.
I also just want to add to what Bishop Catherine has said, but also appeal to the young people that you are not the church of tomorrow. You are the church of today. Take your rightful place. Challenge us. Bring your vibrancy. Ask the questions like you're asking so that together we may encounter God. Thank you.
Bishop Catherine reminded me that there was once, I think, a poster which the Episcopal Church used to use in the United States, which had the slogan, "Christ died to take away your sins, not your mind." And I think that's a very, very good slogan, if I may say so. But why should young people be interested in Christianity at all, in the Anglican Church in particular? In Christianity at all? I would say because the Christian faith puts before us a blazingly imaginative, immense, exciting picture of what it is to be a human being. The Christian faith tells us that God takes us so profoundly seriously as human beings that he pours his life right into the heart of our world and sort of explodes our humanity in love and vision and hope through Christ and the gift of Christ's Holy Spirit. And whatever that is, it's not dull. It may be true or false, and I believe it's true with all my heart, but it's not dull. And one of the most awful things the church can do is to make it dull, which we've succeeded at brilliantly so often, unfortunately. So that's why I think Christianity matters, because it gives us a vision of what it is to be a human being that is so, you know, boiling with life and vision and hope and energy, and gives us also the promise and opportunity of entering into the profundity of God's stillness and God's mystery at the same time. And why be an Anglican? Well, all sorts of reasons, really, but I think partly because of some of what Tabo and Catherine have already said, which is that our tradition tries to keep in play as many things as possible. It says, don't go looking just for an infallible book of rules, and don't treat the Bible like that. The Bible needs to be prayed through and thought through. And for that, you need a bit of help from tradition. That is, from the history of all the other people who've read the Bible before you. And to make the most of that, you need to use your mind. You need to connect things up, ask hard questions, be prepared to wait for an answer. And that threefold pattern, which Anglicans have always treasured, the Bible and the tradition and reason, all sort of going round in circles, illuminating one another. I think that's quite a good way of bringing into play the natural dignity and skill that God's put in our humanity, our reason, bringing into play the legacy of all the wisdom that's accumulated over the ages, tradition, and the tough, unyielding presence of God's revelation in history, a particular story, a particular place that is embodied in Scripture. Keep all those in play, and then we come alive in the way I mentioned earlier, where our humanity explodes.
We now have a question from Emily.
Hi, my name is Emily Anselmi, and I go to St. Peter's School in Cambridge. My question is for the whole panel. To what extent do you think the Bible is still relevant in today's society, given its original social context? And how do you think we should perceive it as a piece of literature?
Thank you very much. That's quite an interesting take as a piece of literature. I think the Bible, for some, is more than a piece of literature. And as Archbishop Robin said, it is a story that we could breathe life into. It is a story that you could dig from the old and put new things, a story that could be relevant in our time, a story that has been relevant in those times. Yes, you're right, when you read the Bible, you need to look at the context in which it was written. But let me share a story from South Africa. During a very difficult time when the people had lost hope and they were asking questions, Lord, where are you in this very depressing context? We read and reread some of the Psalms and we could identify the pain of God's people from that time with the pain of South Africans. And through those stories, we were able to say to all South Africans, please don't go to war. Please don't lose hope. Because God intervened in a people who are like yourselves. And God prevailed. And God will prevail even in a South African context. And look at where we are. We did manage to overcome what seemed to be impossible using the stories in the Bible, the stories of hope, the stories of liberation, and the stories that says it can, things are possible, things don't have to end in hopelessness. So the Bible has that wonderful story that in Jesus' resurrection, everything that may demean you as a human being, everything that may undermine you as a nation does not need to end there. There is hope at the end of the tunnel. So I think if you read and breathe life into the Bible, you'll realize that it does not need saving. Thank you very much.
I think Archbishop Tabo has put his finger on the really essential point here, which is when we read the Bible, we recognize it is actually about people like ourselves. It's not about a mysterious category of religious people who live somewhere in midair. It's about people who struggle and who fail and who protest and who shout in protest to God and who discover and rediscover trust and love. And in all those ways, it's exactly that recognizability that we relate to. But I think the relevance of the Bible is to do with, for me, perhaps one thing above all. It's a story about covenant. It's a story about God promising absolutely to be there with his people. And it's a story of how that promise broadens out just from the one people of Israel to the whole world. God's absolute promise to be there for those that his love touches. And because of that, the community that comes into being in response to God is also a community of promise. We are to be there for one another. We are to be faithful to one another. Faithful to one another's need. Faithful to one another's hopes. And I think that central theme, which is most vividly brought together in the life and death and resurrection of Jesus, that God is simply there with us and nothing can tear him away from this world, that is the foundation, I'd say, for all real ethics, all real moral behavior. It's about being faithful to the image of God in one another and serving that image in one another. That's why it's relevant.
That's a question that's always significant. I want to focus on your question about context. The Bible wasn't written in just one context. It was written in a number of different localities by people wrestling with particular issues in their lives. Their nations were going to war. They were suffering famine. On and on and on. Some of those conditions continue. Most of them continue. when we can interact from our own context with what was going on when that was written and understand both of those, we often discover something quite new, even though the words in the original language have not changed. Several of you asked questions a little while ago about women's leadership in the church. Nobody noticed very carefully who Jesus first spoke to after the resurrection. Mary Magdalene. The Orthodox Church for a long time has called her the apostle to the apostles. But the wider Christian community, until fairly recently, has not connected that with women's authorized leadership in the church. Current context interacts with the context when it was written, and we discover something new in that creative interaction, in that tension. That's one reason we call it the living Word of God, because it continues to inspire and inform us in the place and the communities and the situations we live in today.
Hi, my name is Zach Johns, and I go to Dilworth School. This is a philosophical question for each of you. How can you be so sure that God exists?
It is indeed a philosophical question. I was really touched by one of the hymns that we sang today. He came singing love. He came singing faith. He came singing hope. He came singing peace. I think those biblical values give me the assurance that God does exist. And I do not need to prove it. I have, at a personal level, encountered his love. I have faith, and I pray that we all have the eye of faith. I have hope. And my strife for inner peace, my strife for the peace of the world, also help me to comprehend just a glimpse of God. Thank you.
Thank you for a wonderful question. I started life out as a scientist. Science, that word literally means knowing. And some people wonder how a scientist can also be a person of faith. The wonder of creation is what continues to draw me more deeply into relationship with God. I don't believe in a God who is pulling strings to produce human beings from, earlier kinds of primates. But I do believe in a divine presence that has created a world that can emerge with a sense of being able to love other human beings, that can reflect on the presence of the divine in our midst, that can seek a world where human beings can live together in peace, because there is justice. I experience the presence of God all around me when I am willing to look and open my eyes and my heart. No one of us understands the fullness of who and what God is, yet it is within communities like these that we discover God's presence. I know God's presence. I know God is because of the way I have been created.
It is indeed an absolutely basic question, and I'm very glad that it was asked, because it's an opportunity to say, there are different ways, aren't there, of being sure. I'm sure there's a lectern here in front of me, and that's one kind of certainty. If the lectern weren't there, nothing very much would change about how I think about myself. But there's a sureness that I have about people I love or who love me. There's a sureness about the people that I trust or who trust me. And that kind of knowing that somebody loves me or that I love someone, or knowing that someone is trustworthy, that's certainty of a kind. But it's not just, well, I know there's a lectern in front of me, which is the most boring kind of certainty there is. Now, being sure of God is not being sure that there is something out there with a little label of God on it, like something here with a label called lectern on it. It's much more like the sureness, the certainty of love and trust. And in this case, it's a sense of the universe as such, the universe as a whole, in the way Catherine has described it, being basically grounded in love. And it's by putting yourself into that line of discovery and exploration in trust that the sureness grows. In other words, you can't prove this just on paper or in the abstract. You've got to give it a try. Learning the disciplines of what it might be like to grow in love and trust, to be silent before God, to reflect on the record of God's alleged dealings with people, and see what grows out of that. But I think at the heart of it is this question. Is there just one kind of knowing, just one kind of being sure? Well, absolutely not, if we look at our human nature in its full range. And sometimes we get trapped in imagining that proving the existence of God is just like proving there's something here, like a lectern, as opposed to proving for oneself that this way of living in love and trust is truthful. It has integrity. It corresponds to the way things are. And that, I'm afraid, is a lifetime's work.
Could we please have Daniel to ask a question now?
Hello, my name is Daniel Sewell and I go to King's School. This question is following on from the last one and is for the whole panel. When have you felt closest to God?
Closest to God. In two particular kinds of experience, I think. One is in those very rare moments of silence or trying to be receptive, when somehow or other you just realize God's there. It's not a sort of mystical religious experience, just a feeling, I can't imagine God not being there. Everything else is quiet, everything else is still, and there is, if you like, a sort of breathing presence there, which is just, yes, God. And I think the other kind of experience is when you see people whose lives ought, by all reasonable accounts, to be in shreds, people who seem to have very little reason for hope, who somehow manage to act as if God were real in their love and their hope. I've seen it, and it's one of the privileges of this position, I've seen it in desperately poor parts of the world. I've seen people who might have no reason to hope or to love or to serve, joyfully and generously giving themselves to other people. And if I may quote something I wrote about some years ago. As it happens, I was in New York on September the 11th, 2001. And the day after the horror of 9/11, I was stopped by somebody in the street who asked me, well, where was God yesterday? And I said that the only thing I could think of was that God was in the service that people were doing to make something of all this, the incredible heroism and generosity of lots of very ordinary people going down to help out at Ground Zero. And God was in the messages of love that people sent on their mobiles at the last moment. And it's when you come into contact with that kind of selfless, generous, completely irrational love and hope that you come close to God.
I've experienced God's presence over and over again in a kind of mystical sense of wonder and awe and discovery at the top of a mountain or in a little airplane flying toward a dark cloud and seeing a round rainbow or in the wonder of a newborn child. I've also experienced God most closely in an experience of reconciliation that was unexpected, knowing the presence of God's creativity in the midst of that. And I've also experienced the presence of God most intimately and closely in acts of worship, in a community gathered, not unlike this one. The very willingness and ability to ask these challenging questions is a sign of God's creative spirit at work.
I also support what Archbishop Rowan and Bishop Catherine have said. And I'm not wanting to brag about where I come from, but Cape Town is beautiful. And each time I take walks on my day off and being in touch with nature, I come closer to God. And the other recent time when I've really felt the presence of God's love and care and compassion at work was when Archbishop Rowan addressed a congregation probably four times the size in Harare in Zimbabwe. And most of you may know that there is a renegade bishop who has taken part of the church there away with the support of the current Zimbabwe regime. And we went there probably in trepidation and fear that something could happen to us. But when Archbishop Rowan spoke, the sense of hope, the sense that even the strongest machinery of the Zimbabwean government will not deter the Anglican parishioners there. That for me was God at hand saying, do not be fear, have courage, I am still with you. So I do experience God on occasions like those, and this particular instance was very special to me. And I think we need to give the Archbishop a round of applause for his courage for having stood there. Let's give him a round of applause.
Continue on with the next questions. I'd just like to ask the students just to address their questions to one person because we are on a time limit. So can I please invite Megan to ask your next question?
Hi, my name is Megan Goldsman and I go to St. Peter's School. This question is for Archbishop Rowan. We're at a stage in our lives where we have many options. What made you choose God over any other path you could have taken, and have you ever had a crisis of faith?
Thank you. I think I was amazingly fortunate as a young man to have a Christian community and a Christian priest who were, well, I can only say big enough to make me feel that the Christian faith was simply the most enriching thing around. It was as if everything I was discovering in my studies, especially my studies in literature and history, which were my big enthusiasms when I was a teenager, all of that was not kind of denied, but just deepened and enriched. There was room for it all in the kind of Christianity I was being taught. And I think I felt throughout the years of my teens that it was a sort of steady unfolding of new horizons, wonderful horizons all the time. And then, of course, you come up against the reality of human suffering and misery and guilt and failure, your own and other people's. And I think there have been times in my life when I wouldn't want to talk of a crisis of faith. It's not as if I've said, I'm not sure if I believe this any longer. It was more a case of saying, I can't not believe it, but I have absolutely no idea what's going on or what most of these words mean. It was a bit like being in the middle of the ocean in a boat in the middle of the night. The boat's there, you're not actually drowning, but you have absolutely no idea where you are and how things are working and what lies ahead. And there have been a good few moments like that. And Christians often talk about those moments of being left with no clear signposts, where you just have to hang on by your fingernails. And there's a wonderful line from one of our Anglican poets from the 17th century, George Herbert, who says that a lot of faith is like somebody holding on to a rock face. And he says, clinging and crying, crying without cease, thou art my God, thou art my peace. I've done a certain amount of that.
Could I please ask Sam for your question now?
Hi. My name is Sam Armstrong, and I go to St. Paul's Collegiate in Hamilton. My question is for Bishop Catherine. To what extent do you think science and religion can coexist?
I don't believe it. I've seen it. As I said a little earlier, science means knowing. I live with three stories, three big creation stories. The two in Genesis and the cosmological evolutionary story of creation. Together they give me a far richer view of the world. The scientific story answers questions about mechanism, how things have come to be. The two creation stories in Genesis answer questions about meaning, what it means to be in relationship to something beyond ourselves, someone beyond ourselves, and to other human beings and the rest of creation. If I go through life with only the biblical stories, I have one way of seeing. If I go through life only with the scientific story, I have one way of seeing. Together, I have much better depth perception. I think it's essential to use all of the gifts God has given us to examine the world around us, and to discover God's creativity in everything that is.
It's interesting to hear what you have to say about that issue. Next up, we have Takere, who would like to ask his question.
Hi, my name is Takere Komani, and I go to Dilworth School. This question is for Archbishop Tarbo. What exactly do you do all day as a bishop, and is your job well paid?
I pray. thank you very much. The job is very fulfilling. and I really enjoy it. I start my morning by meditation, then morning prayer, and then we have the staff Eucharist, that is Mass, and then after that, there's a lot of administration that I do, and then after that, from time to time, phone a bishop in our province just to say, hi, how are you, how's it going? And then phone the church commissioners to see if what I'm doing, my traveling, are still within budget and things like those. And I spend a lot of time also reading and reflecting, writing drafts for newspaper articles or for my monthly letters. I'm also on Twitter and Facebook, so I check my Twitter and Facebook and do a couple of postings. And then I fetch my children from school. I have a 16-year-old and a 13-year-old. And at night, I supervise homework, see if they both do their homework, and we end the day with the family having supper together and a short prayer together. So it's quite a full day. I'm not sure what do people get paid for what I do, but I seem to be content with the stipend that I have. We don't call it a salary. We call it a stipend. But besides the monetary value, I think the sense of satisfaction in doing what I do far supersedes the money. I hope I have answered you. If I have not, I've brought with me four ladies from our province. They sit at the most important decision-making bodies of our province. Maybe they could also add, if they want to, Janet, Deline, Louisa, and Rachel. Please stand so that they could see them. So those control the pace of the church.
Thank you very much. Now we have Jordan to ask another question. This question is for Archbishop Rowan.
Hi, my name is Jordan Kane and I go to King's College. As a person, you must have personal opinions about moral and ethical issues. As the leader of the Anglican Church, how do you cope when your own personal views conflict with those of the Church?
A very good question again. I think the answer is related to something I mentioned earlier on. When you're in a public position, you have real responsibilities to a whole community, not just to your own particular judgments. And part of the difficulty of being a bishop at all, but certainly of being Archbishop of Canterbury, is working out what those responsibilities to a whole global community might mean. And that may well mean, in some instances, putting on one side where you as an individual would like things to go and say, now hang on, this is not about me. This is about me and everybody else learning together how the community moves forward. And that will take time, and that will take a lot of that, you know, listening and bridge building, which Catherine talked about. And that can be frustrating. I think if I ever felt that I was required to say in public things I did not believe and could not believe, then I would have to stop doing this job. Now, I am stopping doing this job, but it's not because of that, I hasten to add. But I would feel that was just a wound in my own integrity. As things stand, I can say I have here, as Archbishop, to try and find a language that everyone can speak together in the community, and bring into that all the prayer and the thought that I can, and just, as I say, park my own personal preference and hope that what I most deeply care about will still find a place in that ongoing process of discovery and growth for the community as a whole. So, sorry, long answer to the question, but it's a complex one, and you're right to put your finger on it. And it's something to do with what I believe very strongly is a biblical principle. Together, we know things that none of us knows on our own. If we forget that, the church might as well not exist.
Thank you very much, Archbishop Rowan. Unfortunately, due to time constraints, we are going to have to cut some of the questions. So I'd just like to apologise to Roeth, Kate Voss, Elijah, Alice. Our last question is for Rose to ask, please.
Hi, my name is Rose Spence and I go to St Paul's Collegiate. Here in New Zealand, we have recently had a major earthquake where over 200 people lost their lives. How can you explain the idea of God and his love and plan for everyone when such horrific disasters are occurring?
There will be no answer to this that satisfies everyone. Partly because of what I was trying to say earlier about the fact that our knowledge of God is not just like our knowledge of things or stuff. Let me start from one fact, which is that appalling disasters and appalling sufferings throughout the ages have nonetheless mysteriously not managed to extinguish people's belief in God. People have gone on believing that God is trustworthy, even when faced with horrors such as you describe. That's a fact, and it's not a trivial fact. It does mean that some people's sense of sureness about God doesn't depend on everything going smoothly. The second thing, which I think is important in responding to this, is another simple fact. The world moves on its way by natural processes. Sometimes the working out of those natural processes collides with where human beings are. Just as if I happened to be walking along a mountain road and there were a landslide and I were underneath, my presence and the operation of the laws of nature would collide. Now, that happens quite a bit. It happens, I suppose, you could say, with every case of disease. It seems from the Bible and the way Christians have reflected on it as though God doesn't simply make a world that's always going to be safe, or a world where he will always step in and, if you like, adjust the settings so that nothing ever goes wrong. And that's sometimes very hard to square with the love of God, because we think, don't we, instinctively, well, God ought to be able to come in and adjust the settings. And yet we live in a world where, as I say, natural processes unfold and we have to learn about them. So those are the two things I'm clear about. That some people go through these terrible experiences with faith, and that the world unfolds according to natural laws. In between those, somewhere, lies not an answer, but a way of coping with the challenge of these tragedies. But, like most people, I'm at a loss as to how to give a theory about that. I just hang on to those two ends of the problem and try and keep looking into the darkness in the middle.
I just want to say a huge thank you to all of the students who asked questions today, and just leave you with a question to yourself. If you pray for love, joy, or peace, does God give you love, joy, or peace, or does he give you an opportunity for it?
A huge thank you to our panelists today, Archbishop Rowan, Bishop Catherine Jaffert-Scorey, and Archbishop Thabo Magoba. Next year, Archbishop Rowan will step down from his role as the Archbishop of Canterbury, and will take on the role of Master of Magdalene College at Cambridge University. We wish you every blessing for this.